This is Central Time. Now, how much do we know about the lives of the estimated 1 million plus adults in the United States who identify as transgender? A recent poll by the Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation aimed to add some info to the limited amount of research in that area. One of the big findings was that most of the adults surveyed said they're more satisfied with their lives after they transitioned. We're going to get into the results of that poll and the context of a wave of Republican-led bills targeting trans people in a lot of states. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a trans person yourself, feel comfortable sharing some of your story, love to hear from you. How do you feel in this climate of increased anti-trans legislation in a lot of states? And anybody out there, what questions do you have about the findings, the results of this poll we're going to talk about? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Josie Caballero is director of the U.S. Trans Survey and Special Projects at the National Center for Transgender Equality and NCTE Action Fund. Josie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here in this very important topic.
And Emily Guskin is the polling analyst at the Washington Post, where she specializes in public opinion about politics, elections, and public policy. Emily, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story behind this survey, Emily? What were you and your colleagues and the Kaiser Family Foundation trying to find out here?
So every few years or every year, we try to work with KFF to research a small population in the U.S. that isn't studied maybe as much as other people. And this is a partnership that's been going on for, I think, 36, 39 years, quite some time. And every year we interview a different population. So we've done surveys of opioid addicts. We've done surveys of people who are gamers online. We've done all of these interesting groups. And this year we talked with KFF and we thought it would be interesting to do a deeper dive and talk to people who are trans in the U.S. and how they experience their lives, and to ask them about not just discrimination and hard things that they go through, but how they feel about their lives today and how fulfilled they are and how satisfied they are with their lives.
And Josie, this is a topic of obvious interest to you. You are trying to find the same things in your own polls. Can you talk about this survey and what is out there when it comes to this kind of firsthand research into transgender people talking about themselves?
Absolutely. The poll that was done is very critical because it really does add to the preponderance of evidence that is showing that people who transition actually experience a better quality of life overall. Other surveys that have shown this before, with the U.S. Transgender Survey in 2015, showed that if you are accepted in your community by family, friends, that your outcomes with mental health greatly improve. In fact, we have seen with other surveys such as the Trevor Project that when you actually affirm and give people the ability to be accepted by who they are, that their level of suicidality dropped to no higher than somebody who is not trans.
Let's dig more into that, Emily, that the findings of people's life satisfaction after transition. Here's a quote from one of your respondents in Denver named Josie Nixon. I'm going to quote here from your story. "The worst day I've ever had as a trans person is still better than the best days I had pre-transition." Nixon goes on to talk about living authentically. Can you talk about some of the numbers you heard on this, but also some of the sentiments you heard on this big part of the survey?
That's right. We found that 78% of trans people said that living as a different gender than they were born with, assigned at birth, has made them more satisfied with their lives, including more than 4 in 10 who say they are a lot more satisfied. So that's a huge amount of people saying that this transition that they've gone through, and whether or not that is, I think a lot of people see transition as switching to another gender. We actually found out in the survey that a lot of people are non-binary or don't choose another gender. They just don't use the one that they were assigned when they were born. And that has made this vast majority of people feeling a lot better. Also, we found that they were more satisfied when they physically presented as a different gender, at least most of the time.
And Josie, let's talk more about that concept of transition. I think everybody might hear that word and think it means X, but it could also mean Y and Z. Can you talk about the different meanings of transition we discover when we ask people what it means to them?
Absolutely. Transition takes many different flavors. I like to say, you know, people who go as far as medical transition, where they actually take medication, hormones, and actually have surgical intervention for them to feel more comfortable in their selves. But also, like Emily was talking about with non-binary community members, it could be as simple as a name change, going by different pronouns, or just presenting their outward appearance differently. So anybody who is pretty much going to basically like was said, such as not being the gender that was assigned to you at birth, however that shows up is part of that transition.
That's exactly right. We found that most people have socially transitioned. Most trans people have socially transitioned, which is they changed their clothing or their names or pronouns, but far fewer have medically transitioned. Less than a third have used hormone treatments or puberty blockers, and about one in six have undergone gender affirming surgery or any other surgical treatment to change their physical appearance. So most of trans people who have transitioned are not doing it in surgical or medical ways.
We're talking to Emily Guskin with the Washington Post and Josie Caballero with the National Center for Transgender Equality, looking at polling of transgender Americans about many aspects of their lived experiences. As Emily said earlier, not just discrimination, including that, but other aspects of life as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guests about their surveys? What from this conversation is striking you so far? If you identify as transgender yourself, love to hear your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about what transgender American adults said when polled by the Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation about various aspects of their lives. Our guests today with us, polling analyst Emily Guskin from the Washington Post and Josie Caballero, director of the U.S. Trans Survey and Special Projects at the National Center for Transgender Equality. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, great to be here. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Oh, God, there's just so much. I mean, I guess what I would say is that, you know, transitioning has been so important. I came out, I started living full time as myself. It'll be 9 years ago this July. And, you know, one of the most important things for me was moving to a much more welcoming, trans-friendly state. Wisconsin. I grew up in Missouri, and my partner still lives there. We're hoping he can move up here this fall, but in the meantime, there's a lot of really scary things happening. You know, Missouri is preparing to pass legislation that would define anything I do within view of more than one person as a strip show. You know, if somebody was watching me talk to you lovely people, that would legally be a strip show, and NPR would be, you know, penalized accordingly. But more realistically, a restaurant that I go to, if people see me there, they'll be closed down, you know. And my partner has a day job, but he also makes a lot of his income from performances. And anything he does in terms of, you know, public readings or so on, that would be completely shut down. And to cap it all, Missouri's attorney general just unilaterally banned all forms of transition-related health care for everyone.
Elise, thank you for sharing your experience. Josie, can you talk about that? We have these surveys. We also have this reality of a lot of legislation, like the ones in Missouri that Elise was talking about, specifically targeting transgender people, their open expression of identity, and some of the medical care involved.
Absolutely. It cannot be understated that there is nearly 500 anti-trans pieces of legislation across this country. And it really, we need to center the crisis, right? And when we look at these pieces of legislation, luckily for the caller, we are winning in the courts, and that's really, really important. But at the end of the day, we need to speak loudly that we do not support this. We have to underscore that this is being done by the radical extreme folks that feel that trans people shouldn't exist, when most of the country believe that trans people are okay by a large margin. And this is a desperate call to try to target a marginalized group of people to try to push their political agenda when this is real people's lives on the line, as we just heard from the caller. So you know, and I will give it to Wisconsin. You did elect Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford to be the first openly trans woman elected in Madison, Wisconsin City Council. And so that shows evidence right there that we can win and we are a part of everyday life.
Thanks for that call. And Emily, your poll tried to get at transgender people's perception of everybody else's perception of them, if that makes sense. What did you find?
Yeah, I also wanted to touch on something else our poll founded. The caller mentioned that they moved from a different place for more acceptance. And we asked in the survey whether trans people had ever moved to a different part of town or a different city or state because they thought it would be a more accepting place for someone who is trans to live. And 27% said that they had, which is a minority, of course. The 27% is not a majority, but it's still a pretty significant amount of people who said that they moved for more acceptance. And I can imagine that with this increased level of anti-trans legislation in certain states, that number could increase in the future if we were to go back into the field and ask other people what they thought about moving for more acceptance. I'm sorry, what was your question before there?
Oh, actually, I want to bring on one more caller before we run out of time. Andrew is with us in Eau Claire. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up, well, I mean, first let me say, I think it is just absolutely terrible what is going on in a lot of these red states. I feel ashamed as an American that the rest of the world has to watch sort of the hate and vitriol that is being directed at a minority population, for starts. But I wanted to talk. I'm the father of a trans child, and you know, I heard, you know, what you guys are talking about how, you know, it brings, you know, satisfaction to their lives and improves their, you know, quality of life. You know, two of the days that I remember my kiddo being the happiest they've ever been were the day that they had their name legally changed and the day that they started taking testosterone. And I'll never forget that. How, what a difference it made in their life, and how, you know, now going forward, like that just, that changed everything for them.
Andrew, thanks for the call. And Josie, I'll give you the last word on that. Your thought on Andrew's experience with his kid.
You know, I'm so happy that is the experience that is coming through, because that gives life to the data, right? It's the truth. It is a happy parent seeing the happiness of their child come through. And I don't know, like, that is why we do this work. This is why we do the data to acknowledge what it is. And I will give my little personal anecdote. I transitioned at 34 years old, and I never truly experienced happiness until after I transitioned. And it is such a real thought. And I'm so grateful that that parents are allowing their children to experience that joy sooner so they can discover their true identities, because it's always there. What a great note to leave on.
We'll leave it there. Josie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Emily, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I've
been talking to Emily Guskin, polling analyst at the Washington Post, and Josie Caballero, director of the U.S. Trans Survey and Special Projects at the National Center for Transgender Equality, looking at a new Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation survey asking about transgender adults' lived experience in the United States. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Bed Bath & Beyond filed for bankruptcy this week, announced it'll be closing all of its stores, including several here in Wisconsin. The move isn't a surprise for the company, which has been reporting financial trouble for some time now. But that's just one part of the story for big box retailers. According to CoreSite Research, 2022 was the first time in the last 6 years that major U.S. retailers opened more stores than they closed, with the largest growth from discount stores. The most closures came from apparel companies. Companies like Barnes & Noble, Ross Stores, and TJX Stores are planning to add dozens of new locations this year. So what's going on? Why are some retailers adding to their brick-and-mortar footprint while others are closing down? Hart Posen is professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business and an expert on business strategy. I talked to him earlier this year about trends in the retail industry. Here's a listen. Now, before we start naming names, big picture, we've been talking over the course of the pandemic, and now, you know, online shopping went up, of course. Is that going to stay? What are you looking at lately as far as our preference from shopping online versus going to a store?
Well, you know, the way I look at it is actually has, you know, our preferences for online versus in-store are clearly important. But I think what's going on in a lot of the dynamics in store openings and closings and comings and goings is driven by retailers trying to figure out how to accommodate our preferences, how to make sense of what we want, and to redesign their stores and their online experience to match that.
Now, looking at particular names, I mentioned a couple big names that are closing stores in Wisconsin, but for different reasons. Let's start with Bed Bath & Beyond. It seems like this is a chain that is having some serious problems.
Well, Bed Bath & Beyond has been having serious problems for a long time. You know, it is. I think it has less to do at Bed Bath & Beyond with the changing nature of retail and more to do with the fact that for Bed Bath & Beyond, it's really darn hard to figure out what the heck they're about. You know, you might wake up on a Saturday morning and say, we have to go to Walmart today, or I want to go to TJ Maxx today. But when do we want to go to Bed Bath & Beyond? And it's really hard to figure that out, and it has been for so long.
Now, we were talking actually during the news about hairstyles, but also about some of these issues in retail. And sometimes when we see, okay, oh, a brick and mortar retail chain's having trouble, it's closing or struggling or whatever, we say, oh, that's Amazon. That's online competition. That is not the universal cause here.
That is not. And we misunderstand the world if we blame everything on online retail. In fact, you know, some of the firms that are growing the most, TJ Maxx, for instance, does relatively small share of their business online purposefully. It's not that they're failing online. It's they've made a choice.
Now, I mentioned there's a Walmart store closing in the Milwaukee area. That is a different, that's a symptom of something different than the Bed Bath & Beyond closures.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Walmart has gained some ground in trying to understand and make sense of online retail. You know, when you see Walmart closing stores and opening stores, because they're doing both simultaneously, it really has more to do with the changing demographics and the changing age of stores, et cetera. This is not a sign of a problem.
Now, I mentioned there are chains expanding, and we'll talk about some of the particular ones. It seems like in the past, hey, my chain, my big box chain is doing really well, or my mall store is doing well. Let's open 50 more this month and 100 more next month. It seems like there's a lot more, I don't know what, intentionality, caution, choosiness as these stores expand. Do I have that right?
Well, you know, I think This is right, because there was so much overexpansion for so long of stores that were really hard to distinguish from one another. You know, you walk into a mall and all the, let's say, the young person's fashion stores, it was really hard to tell them apart. And now I think what you see, though, is a different avenue for growth. In the past, the avenue for growth was open more stores, whether here or else in other geographies. But now the avenue for growth is can we rethink about the mix between physical stores and online, get that mix right as a way to maximize revenue and growth?
Now, there's this company, let me flip through my notes here, looking at opening some more in-person stores, Amazon. What?
Well, you know, Amazon has been playing around with this for some time, and of course they own Whole Foods already, which is one of the larger grocery chains in the U.S. They have been dabbling in what to do in brick and mortar, because they too realize that it's not a story of brick and mortar or online. It's a story you have for your business, for your product, for your service. What is the right mix?
Now, the first casualties of Amazon, and I think this did have a lot to do with Amazon, was bookstores. You know, Borders, yeah. Used to go to Borders. There's no more Borders. Small bookstores, they made a comeback some. Now, Barnes & Noble adding stores, but a little different approach, it looks like.
Yeah, you know, look, there's a lot of the number one reason Barnes & Noble is still in business is publishers need them in business. The last thing the publishers want, forget about you and me for a second. We might want them as well. The last thing the publishers want is the last bookstore, major bookstore chain, to go under, because that then puts them in even a tougher position with Amazon on book sales. So the publishing industry needs Barnes & Noble to survive. Huh. And there are clearly lots of people like me and you who want Barnes & Noble to survive. And you know, the other part of this, we tend to go to extremes, right? You know, a few years ago it was, online retail will demolish all brick and mortar. And this has proved not true. And if you go back a few years, it was ebooks will demolish physical books. This is not true either. There's some combination of the two. In my household, we buy a lot of ebooks and we buy a lot of physical books.
We're talking Hart Posen from UW-Madison School of Business, looking at the latest news in the world of retail. You could share your shopping habits, how they've changed or not, online on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hart, heard a few different perspectives there. David wrote, I stopped going, meaning stopped going to retail stores when they made me cashier without pay. I have a little attitude like that with David, like, you want me to go through, you got to give me a broom, I'll sweep up too a little bit. How is this affecting the user experience at stores?
Well, let me tell you a story first. The story first is that what we think of as retail, physical retail, brick and mortar retail today, is not what it looked like historically, right? There was Rob behind the counter, all the goods were behind the counter.
Right.
The emergence of the idea of putting price tags on stuff meant you didn't have to have a skilled negotiator behind the counter. And it turned retail into self-service. A store is a self-service warehouse located close to home. Now, the questioner's comment says, boy, they're even making me do more and more of it. In the old days, you used to walk to the store, get a cart, walk around, pick stuff off the warehouse shelf in the store, take it to the counter, and someone did the checkout. Now we're just removing the checkout part. But this is a trend that's been going on for decades.
Now, there's a labor connection here. Now, I see, I was looking at who was adding jobs in January. Retail seasonally adjusted 30,000 extra jobs. Not huge in the scope of things. Thoughts that a lot of stores may be keeping their seasonal workers on hand. What was happening with retail during the labor shortage, as people described it?
Well, you know, labor rates in a lot of retail environments have gone up a lot. Walk into your neighborhood or Target and see that the starting wages may be $15 or more an hour, which is significantly higher than it used to be. And this idea of holding, you know, given the uncertainty about the labor pool right now, these folks don't want to let you go if you come. And so they have some strong incentive to hold on to you.
Now, Lisa wrote, I prefer to shop at small stores in my community. Most have everything I need. I'll sometimes get things online rather than shopping at a big box store. Interesting. So I'll go small and local, or I'll just go online, forget the big boxes.
You know, this is a tough thing, right? We were just talking about Barnes & Noble, right? Whereas, you know, what's that movie? You've Got Mail. Mm-hmm. The big bookstore was the demon. Now the big bookstore is the savior. and you know, in online retail for years, you know, as Amazon has gained more and more market power, as they've gained, because they have an overwhelming share in online retail. In online retail, we have to hope for Walmart as the savior. And so it is this confusing thing that just to be, you know, for the caller's point, I do too want the diversity of local retailers that bring a diversity of goods and a diversity of good to our community.
And then we heard from Jacqueline, who writes, I'm 67 with mobility issues, so I shop online with Walmart. I have a store delivery. Now, the thing that accelerated, I think, during the pandemic was accessibility for someone like Jacqueline or people with a lot of causes why they can't go and shop around a store. That has given them a lot more options.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's a universal good or bad. There are different people with different preferences and different needs. And I think that, you know, an apocalyptic view that one type of retail will destroy all others, I think we've proved time and time again, that's not the way it ever turns out to be.
Now, I had originally written in our script, retail was in flux. But then I took that out, because, right, when is retail not in flux?
Ever since you and I have been talking, retail has been in flux.
And probably before that, I'm guessing. Right? I mean,
we're pretty old.
Big picture, Hart, there's a sort of evolution to the retail business. Can you give us that?
Yeah, and there always has been, right? When big box bookstores pushed out mom and pop bookstores, but and then Amazon pushed out big box bookstores. The same has happened in consumer electronics. You know, we have this tendency to think that what we see today is the way it we always should be and always was. And there's an inherent fallacy in that, right? You know, the biggest retailers a few decades ago were firms like Sears. Now they've basically disappeared. The flux is forever. The only question is, when will Walmart and Amazon disappear? Will it be in 30 years or 50 years? But the one thing we can predict for sure, it will change.
What are you watching for? Maybe not on that time horizon, but in the year to come in the retail world.
You know, I think that this change in thinking about the nature of the mix between online and in-person. You brought up Barnes & Noble opening some smaller stores to mix in with their larger stores. And I think retailers are becoming much more sophisticated in how they mix brick and mortar and online, how they make them work together. And there's a lot of learning going on. A lot of learning happened during the pandemic, and it'll continue.
Hart, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, as always.
That's Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at UW-Madison, an expert on business strategy. We listened back to a conversation about why some big box retailers are cutting back their brick and mortar presence while others are expanding.